right now, my guest tonight, is somebody we had on the program last year, transitional engineer Susan Krumdiek, who's based in Christchurch. She came on the show last year. I thought when I was going to speak to Susan, she would be talking about, well, transitioning to new ways of creating energy, the energy we need to live our lives as we live them now. However, Susan suggested that maybe we also need to transition away from our current lifestyle. And she's back again as a regular guest this year. Kia ora, Susan. Welcome back to Nights.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Now, right now, the big story is COVID-19. It's like we've kind of forgotten all about that transition to away from a carbon-free economy, haven't we? I mean, now we've got some real news to deal with.
Well, we've got some immediate concerns, indeed.
Exactly.
Now, you might recall that we declared some emergencies last year regarding the climate, and we didn't take any immediate action on that. So I find it really heartening that we can take immediate action when we get it, when we get the threat.
You find that more heartening than kind of like humans are strange kind of reaction?
Are we strange?
Well, we're human, aren't we?
When we see an immediate threat to us that we can feel for ourselves, then we are alert, and we have a heightened sense I don't want to say fear, but I guess it is kind of fear. And responsibility isn't quite that same sort of heightened experience. It's more waiting to find out what you really need to do, I guess.
And there's a momentum, and there's an acceptance of change. There aren't many people right now saying, why? Okay, it's difficult. And there are people who are hurting big time economically from the changes that have been made, the things we've done in terms of slowing down the number of people coming to the country and the self-isolation stuff and no more cruise ships. And that's creating real hardship for some people already, not to mention the exporters who can't send stuff to China at the moment. But still, on the whole, there's an acceptance of the need for change. I'm not seeing anyone on social media saying this COVID-19 is, some kind of conspiracy from the Greenies to shut the economy down. But maybe I'm not looking hard enough.
Okay, besides Donald Trump, you mean?
Yeah. But even he seems to be accepting that COVID-19 is something his administration has to do something about.
He has. He has, finally. Good on him. Yeah.
But Carry on, Susan.
So what I think is that now that we have taken extraordinary measures, I hope it'll give us a chance to ask ourselves, what are we really capable of adapting to, and start to get creative about how we adapt. I've seen some of the blogs that people are doing about their isolation, their self-isolation. I think that adaptation, our ability to solve problems and to come up with new things, it doesn't get kicked into gear as much by anything as by necessity. And so here we are with necessity. I think we'll find some amazing things that people come up with to deal with this.
2019 were both years where there are already events happening which were modelled by the specialists in climate change, the climate specialists, many years beforehand. See, nothing that they've said is likely to happen has not happened. The models keep on being more or less right. So in 2019, however, our emissions, and is this global or just New Zealand, went up by their largest percentage for, since ever?
There were a few countries that their emissions went down a little bit, but globally, no. It was the biggest increase in emissions from the largest emissions ever. So we emitted the most ever, and it was the biggest increase. So really nothing to say that we got it, that we understood the enormity of the situation and that we were willing to take bold action. Not really there.
So when you teach your kids, sorry to use that phrase, but I think it was in your notes, so I'm going to blame you. When you teach your students in your engineering course, and you say, well, look, this is what we've been doing and this is what we've known about, how do they say, well, look, it's just not possible. Us humans don't seem to be capable of adapting to this thing.
No, I think there's something really cool about 22 to 25-year-olds, and that is that they can understand information, so that's good, and they're usually pretty stressed to find out what the actual information is, because the whole climate change, the way that it's talked about that they've ever heard of before is as if it was a political issue, when actually it's just a cause and effect, you know. And so we learn about the thermodynamics and the heat transfer and then the chemistry and the radiation properties of the different greenhouse gases. And it kind of gets away from the politicalness of it. And you see that politicalness isn't about the climate change itself. It's about that. I think the biggest thing is we don't know what to do about it. Because what's obvious that we need to do is to reduce the amount of fossil fuels we produce and adapt to using less. But that is outside the reach of our prime minister or anybody else, isn't it? I don't know, maybe.
However, Susan, in the last few months, now I'm willing to wager right now that greenhouse gas emissions, the burning of fossil fuels, has dropped globally. I put money on it, lots of money on it right now. There are clean skies over China. There are clearing skies over Europe. We are not burning as much fossil fuel. We are not flying as much. COVID-19 is doing more for the reduction of greenhouse gas consumption, or at least production, fossil fuel consumption, than anything we've managed to do as humans in terms of agreeing to stuff on paper and in treaties or anything like that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm gearing up to study this in my research, I have to say, because this, I guess, unintended consequence of COVID-19, because it isn't just that the flights aren't going and therefore something changed. It actually is affecting the whole supply chain. So the production of cars is slowing down. The production of plastics is slowing down. So it is really fascinating to see, can we just adapt to that? I hope we sort of can get past the panic of the virus and start doing that adaptation and innovation that I've been talking about, that I have faith that we can do. And maybe it's a really good time for transition engineering, because that's sort of the space that we work in. Is we call it the how do we space, that where you sort of know what you do have to do, but how do we do it?
I think in terms of containing the virus, something I think that changed the way people in the West viewed this was when we started to see what was happening in Italy. When we realized this doesn't just happen in Asian nations or in Middle Eastern nations like Iran. It happens in a Western nation with a well-developed hospital system. That was when everyone started to realize in countries like New Zealand and elsewhere that this is a disease we have to take seriously.
Oh, I think probably for Western countries, you might have said, well, the Italians, they do that kiss-kiss thing, right? So, you know, but when Tom Hanks gets it.
Yep, true. That's right.
Now it's a Western thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you
it must be out there, because how would he get it?
Yeah. But when you talk about the moves that we are prepared to do now to slow down the spread of COVID-19, so that if we're lucky enough in a country like New Zealand, elsewhere they're trying to just slow it down so their health system can eventually catch up with it. In New Zealand, we might be, if we're lucky, be able to keep it to such a level that our health system is basically able to cope with whatever comes through the door in terms of people who get sick with it, and everyone will get really good care if they are seriously ill with it. But there is a cost with this, and that is the number of people who are losing income, who have lost their jobs. And there'll be people listening to you saying that COVID-19 is something which is good in terms of fossil fuel emissions, but it's hurting them in the pocket, maybe leading to hardship.
Okay, so if we were to brainstorm about that, any time that you have a system that you are running a particular way and it experiences a fault, then it doesn't work anymore. That's just the way it goes. I mean, that's just true. And so how fast or how resilient you are to figure out how to reset that system, or so resilience is how to get it back working again, or how to adapt and find new ways to do what's important. And that's where COVID-19 is going to help us to bring out words and ideas like essentiality and necessity and what's really important. Because I know, like, some of my family members, they thought their the American family members, their annual ski trip to the Alps to go skiing, that was really important to them. Yeah, and they were planning on doing it, and they're all disappointed that it didn't go. And yet, is it actually important? It's not as important as their health, that's for sure. And so just this resetting of what's important. And like you said, people got their jobs pulled out from under them, but that doesn't mean they're incapable of work. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, okay, a little while ago, when we were thinking about what we wanted to do when we got older, what are we going to, you know, end up as? Most of the people in my class, really, they planned to own their own business, to run their own farm, to run their own restaurant, to do their own thing. And now we think that we have to have a job from somebody else. So I think that we probably still have the innovation to look around us and wonder what needs doing. Our supply chains from around the world are falling down. So what do we need? And I think you'll be surprised that we can provide for each other what we need if we look up and say, well, you know, what am I good at? What can I do? And how could I possibly find out what people need or what needs doing? Well, we have an internet thingy, surely. The innovation and the problem solving is going to come out of the woodwork here.
If we are not, because a lot of people right now, I think, Susan, are thinking, we'll weather this storm, we'll get through mm-hmm. the virus, we'll contain it, we'll eventually get a vaccine for it, and we go back to just how we were before.
What are
some of the things?
Sacrificed everything for nothing.
But what are some of the things that we could do? Essentiality. What do you mean by that?
Essentiality. All right. Well, water, health, food, there are things that are essential to life. And your whānau is essential to life as well, and your community. And a governance structure that provides freedom for people. There are things that are essential to our way of life. We have become comfortable in things that aren't, in having things that aren't actually essential. And we give them too much importance, really, sometimes. Let's say that this whole thing disrupts the supply chain for oil. We've definitely been using less oil. Because we've been flying less and moving less ships and that sort of thing. But what if the supply chain to New Zealand got disrupted? It comes through Asia. What would we do? We would do what's important first, hopefully. That's what we would do. And the things that are optional, while they might be normal and we're used to them, we would call them optional for a reason. And I guess maybe those of us who lived through the Christchurch quakes, we found out what's essential, and we sort of figured out what needed doing and how to help take care of other people and help them dig out. And, you know, we aren't always good at it, but I would hate to think that we would ever say that we didn't learn something from that.
You mentioned people. Sorry to interrupt, Susan, but you mentioned before people people you know deciding, well, actually, I don't need to go on that ski trip to Europe, and I live in the United States. I don't need to do that. I can have a good holiday in the United States, closer to home. What about? But that's only part of the thing that drives our use of fossil fuels, isn't it? It's one important part, but it's not the only thing. What about all the stuff that we buy?
Stuff is a big one. The manufacturing of goods requires an awful lot of coal and oil and gas. And I think people are starting to see that sort of supply chain disruption where, you know, the goods aren't flowing around the world like they used to. And a funny thing about that, the fact that we don't have warehouses full of goods anymore is a development called just-in-time shipping that's come along with our modern way of moving stuff in what's called intermodal freight, where you have stuff in containers, move it around. And so that that way of moving things around where you don't have local people producing things anymore, you just have this continuous conveyor belt of cargo and freight moving around the planet. That has actually contributed a huge amount to the fuel you use to do the same thing. And so it's been actually for quite some time that we needed to rethink that system because it just uses more fuel to do what we need to do.
Yeah. You can see the container loads of stuff coming out of the port of Tauranga and heading up by train to Auckland. It's just one example of that stuff. But a lot of that used to be made here in New Zealand. But there's one thing, I mean, I can relate to that. But I do think if we stopped that and created more local stuff and consume less, what does it mean for all the people who are building that stuff in places like China or India? What does it mean for them? Because this manufacturing boom in China has brought a lot of people in that country out of poverty, hasn't it? Out of rural subsistence.
Okay. Now, that's been a question for a long time because, you know, back in the 80s, the factories started moving out of America and moving to Mexico and China, Korea. And the people who lost their really good paying jobs in America in manufacturing then got to buy the cheaper stuff made by people who were getting paid a really bad wage in bad working conditions from another place. But the argument always was, well, at least those people have jobs. But that displacement of traditional agricultural life for work in a factory, I don't know that it's a giant step up. I think it's a change, and it's a thing that countries have to work through. But it's not been a win-win for the countries that lost their high-quality manufacturing, and it's not been a win-win for the countries that got those factories put into their, you know, into their usually not quite ready for worker rights or worker safety protection. We've had the odd safety thing happen in Bangladesh and other places. So what factories and big companies want to do to increase their profit isn't always the thing that's the best for the workers. And those workers who you say are losing their jobs in countries where they should be making things, there's got to be other ways than the way we're doing it now. This way isn't sustainable on so many levels. Let's start asking those questions of, okay, what next? And I really do think we'll find what next if we look.
Susan, thanks so much for joining us again. Look forward to speaking to you again in about 3 months from now.
Sure.
That's Susan Krumdiek, transitional engineer at Canterbury University, back with more thoughts on transitioning away from a fossil fuel dependent existence for humanity in, as I said, about 12 weeks from now.